From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. No one wants to be gay. No one chooses to be transgender. That's according to one of my guests, a local psychologist who specializes in LGBTQ plus issues. There's a lot of pain, she says, that goes along with being lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer. According to the Trevor Project, suicide is the second leading cause of death among young people ages 10 to 24, and LGBT kids consider and attempt suicide at much higher rates than straight kids. Family acceptance plays a key role. Those LGBT kids who come from families who reject their identity are more than 8 times as likely to attempt suicide. While gender identity and sexual orientation are protected classes under the Civil Rights Act, that protection only goes so far and obviously cannot and does not mandate social acceptance. But even the legal fight for equal rights is itself a work in progress. The Hill reports recently passed laws in Arkansas and West Virginia restricting transgender rights are unconstitutional. The Department of Justice argues the laws, which would exclude transgender girls from women's sports and ban gender-affirming care, violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution's 14th Amendment. When we talk about LGBTQ issues, it's the T we often leave out of the discussion. That's at least in part because the T's are a minority, even inside the community. But are they small in number? Because they're small in number, or because it's a much harder road to take. Today, on this third edition of Queer in the Cape Fear, we're seeking to do a better job of understanding the T and what it really means to be transgender. With me today, Nova Swanstrom. She's a psychologist who specializes in LGBTQ plus issues. Nova Swanstrom, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
T.R. Nunley is program coordinator for Wilmington Transgender Support Services. He is a leader, activist, and advocate for the LGBTQ plus community, and he is a trans man. T.R. Nunley, welcome, and thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Great to have you with us. Also with us today, Darlene. She is the mother of a teenager who is transgender. We're not using her last name or her child's name in order to protect their privacy. Darlene, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having this conversation.
Now, Darlene, I want to start with you so we can kind of learn about your journey as the parent of a transgender teen. How did you and your husband grow up, and what was your thinking about transgender people or the transgender issue before you learned about your own child?
We both grew up in Eastern North Carolina. We both came from Southern Baptist families who were heavily involved in the church. We probably both had some exposure to transgender people in our 20s, in nightclubs, whatever. But I only had more experience with a gay cousin, but no relationship with a transgender person, and almost no knowledge of what it meant to be transgender.
So your learning curve on this has been almost entirely because of and around your child.
Exactly.
And so we're going to get to some of the discoveries that you've made and are making. But Nova Swanstrom, help us understand this from a more academic point of view. First of all, is it a mental illness?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And to segue into that, I'd like to comment first on nobody wants to be gay. I don't necessarily think it's that nobody wants to be gay. There's nothing wrong with being gay, queer, trans. It's part of human diversity. It's that I believe that many people would not say, that looks really cool. I'm gonna go be trans now. I'm gonna go be gay now. It's not rewarding like that. It is a very difficult path, not because of it, but because of our society and how society reacts to those who are different. So regarding mental illness, so I'm a member of WPATH, which is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. And we are fighting to get it taken out of the DSM, which is our Diagnostic Statistical Manual. Yes, there can be complications that arise. Most of those complications are external. When we're talking about suicide, the number one factor to transgender teens attempting suicide is lack of family support. So is it a mental illness? No, it's part of human diversity.
And on that note, I love that you call it human diversity, because this has been part of my own learning curve in terms of understanding gender. And many people don't see gender as a complex idea. But you've said before that a lot of what we know about sex identity is from plants. And to many, this is just a binary question. Are you male or female? But starting out with just the psychology of this, the biology, not the psychology. Why is biological gender more complex than some people might think, and not necessarily binary?
I think it's exposure. I think when we aren't used to something, we don't know enough about it. And then the more we think we know, like really, those of us who think we are experts, the more we realize we don't know. So to piggyback off of that, with plants, we've really only been studying gender, human gender, for maybe about 150 years based on plants. And plants, you have plant parts that are male or female plant parts. But when we go to mammals, when we go into more complex creatures, which would be us, we see that it's not so black and white. 1 in 20,000 male assigned at birth people are actually chromosomally XX. When we look at, hyenas, I believe it's the spotted hyena, where the female spotted hyenas have phalluses. They have something that looks like a penis, and it's not. It's anatomy that is just different. So when we look at diversity, when we look at differences, we try to compartmentalize them. We try to look at taxonomy. We love the use of labels, and sometimes we need to broaden the labels we have available.
We know that being transgender is a difficult road, and a lot of people have tried to deny it to themselves. And T.R. Nunley, you've said that you're one of those people who this didn't even come into your awareness until you were into your adult years. Can you talk about starting to recognize that you might be transgender?
Yeah, I was having some deep discussions with someone I was dating, and you know, through those discussions, she challenged me to, because she grew out her armpit hair and her leg hair. And at the time, I was shaving everything. And so she said, why don't you just like try just to grow out your hair? And then she said that she would shave her hair, kind of just challenge. And I'm dating her, and so I'm like, sure, I can do that. And
just to be clear, at the time, you were living as a woman.
Correct.
And so
identified as female at that point, and as a lesbian. But the more, you know, masculine that I looked, the better I felt about myself. But I still wasn't really accepting it about myself. I took maybe about a year to be introspective, going back and forth.
While you were taking that year, what kinds of questions were you asking yourself? What kind of introspection was going on?
I guess what it means to be male. And it'd be like silly things like taking online quizzes, or, you know, having deep discussions with other people. But I was too afraid to come out as trans. I actually spoke to Nova about it. And then I had an opportunity to go to Philadelphia, and I went to a support group there, and because I was too afraid to go to the support groups here in Wilmington, I went to this group in Philadelphia, met some trans people, again, had some deep discussions, and after that meeting, I was like, okay, I'm trans, but now what? And, you know, and looking back on my life, there were so many clues, you know, that I was trans. I just sort of suppressed everything. You know, I would have these arguments with my mom about clothing. You know, she wanted me to dress in dresses and skirts and stuff, and I just wasn't having it. And I'd have these horrible fights and crying, you know, and then, you know, I would always be the dad in play when I was a kid. And so it just makes sense now, back then, that, yeah, I was a trans kid, but nobody knew. Nobody had the language, and certainly my parents weren't educated on the topic. And so the older I got, the more good about, I guess, I got at suppressing all of those thoughts and feelings. And so when I was about 33, 34 years old, you know, I just decided, okay, I'm going to choose to be happy.
And we're going to find out, once you decided that you were trans, what happens after the now what. You're listening to Coastline. It's the third edition of Queer in the Cape Fear, with a focus on the transgender community. We'll be back from this short break in 90 seconds. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Being queer in the Cape Fear region may or may not bring open public harassment, but when we talk about what straight people can't see and often don't understand, we don't spend a lot of time on the T of the LGBTQ. The T stands for transgender, and today we're seeking to understand this. Here to help us do that, Nova Swanstrom, a psychologist who specializes in LGBTQ issues, T.R. Nunley, program coordinator for Wilmington Transgender Services and a trans man himself, and Darlene, who is the mother of a trans teenager. Now, T.R., just before we went to break, you were telling us how you finally arrived at the recognition that you were trans, and that as you lived more as a man, you started to feel better about yourself. And you said once you had the recognition that you are a man, then the question becomes, now what?
Right.
What's embedded in that question?
Well, it's kind of like choose your own adventure, in a way. You can decide, you know, if you want to do hormones or not, if you want to have surgery or not, and if you want support. So, I think after a year of advocating for the LGBT community and being introspective, I was just ready to lift that burden off of my shoulders, because the more that it's like once you figure out that you're trans, it now becomes like almost like a secret that you're keeping from everybody else. And it just sort of built up to a point where I was like, you know, I was afraid to come out to people. I was afraid of rejection, of friends, family, jobs. And I think you know, after that year, that burden was just too much to carry.
Can I ask just about the, so you were already out when you were living as a woman, mm-hmm. you were out as a lesbian.
Yes.
And you were involved in the LGBTQ community in Wilmington.
Right.
So friendly community. But you didn't want to go to the support group here. You didn't feel safe. What were you, you talk about being afraid of rejection. And I think a lot of people can understand the job piece of it. That's mm-hmm. a step to take. And perhaps the family that you're born into. But the friends around you, why were you afraid of that?
Because there was a division between the lesbian and gay community and the trans community. And there wasn't that many out trans people that were able to kind of go in between those two communities. And I was hosting a lot of lesbian events. And I was just afraid that I just wouldn't be accepted in those spaces. And, you know, when I did come out, you know, I was one of the first trans people that was able to go through those communities, actually. People accepted me for who I was, and I think a large part was because I was so active in the LGBT community, that they were like, of course we accept you, but you never think that going into it. You always, in the back of your mind, think that everyone's gonna leave you. And so, again, you have to decide, okay, I'm gonna tell everybody and risk everything to be happy. And I did that, and I was lucky. People accepted me for who I was and continued to accept me and support me through my path. Yeah.
Darlene, you have a teen who is transgender, and you told us earlier that you grew up in a rather traditional North Carolina kind of setting. And so this was a relatively new issue for you when your child came out to you. Can you take us back to when your child came to you with this information and how you processed it?
Yes. It was only about a year and a half ago. And so I, thinking back, can't see that I had any signals, although in middle school my child was dressing rather androgynously, but I had absolutely no problem with that. I was fabulously thrilled at more cover-up and less skin showing. And but then when they came out to me, it was about 10 o'clock at night. I was packing for a trip the next morning and in my bathroom, and they come in and shut the door and say, I have to tell you something. And they say, I'm trans. And I just said, okay. And they said, I want to tell Dad. And I said, do we have to do that right now? It's late. We have to get up in the morning. And
what were you afraid of?
I just didn't know what the conversation would be. And I felt like I had sort of, my okay was about as far as I could go at that moment. I didn't really, of course, I was focused on two things at once. And then they went in the bedroom and said to Dad, I'm trans. And Dad said, okay. And I probably have never been so relieved. I could cry right now thinking about it, as I was then, that we were both just able to say, okay. It was the beginning of a journey. I don't think we went very far that night at all. That's literally all I can remember of that night. And then we came back from our little weekend away and proceeded with a lot of schooling from our child on pronouns. They wanted to change their name. They did change their name, not legally, but they changed the name that they went by. That, of course, is hard. We are not young people. We have been, you know, calling this child the same thing all their life. We are of a generation where they was taught to be plural and probably almost beaten into us that it was plural. So adopting they, them pronouns was a struggle. We messed up every day. We still mess up every day. And then there were so many things, non-binary, gender fluid, asexual, aromantic, all these things that we had never naming things, you know, that had to do with gender and sexual orientation. And we have a young teen, so that has been, you know, kind of a sort of a, I'm not sure how much they understand about sexual orientation. I think I'm pretty on top of it as a mom, but gender identity, I think they understand. I'm convinced that they understand. And our counselor, who is Nova, has been incredibly, incredibly instrumental in that.
Nova Swanstrom, the coming to understand and the grappling with this has to be different for a biological parent than it might be for, say, a best friend or even a spouse. Can you talk about some of the unique challenges that a parent faces when considering or reconsidering the gender of their child?
Well, that's a complicated question, but I think at the basis of it, it's the recognition that for a child or a teen to come out, there's often, hopefully, a relief, a benefit from it. You know, I'm expressing my authenticity. I'm moving forward towards hopefully something favorable. For parents, it's not quite like that, usually. Usually it's the fears flood through them. The fear of their child is going to be unlovable, that their child is going to be a freak, that their child is going to be hate crimed against. All these thoughts swarm through parents, and then there's the grief, the loss of the child they thought they had, the loss of the loss of the thought of who they thought their child was now, and then the loss of who they imagined their child to grow up into being. And then parents think, I would know, I'm their parent, I would have seen it, or how could I have missed that? I think, and that's where working with parents, it's letting parents kind of have their own path because it's their transition also. And their path is very different from the path of the teen or the child because it's fraught with thoughts of negatives versus positives.
Like loss. Not that, loss of the child they knew.
Yes, yes. They're thinking about the negative things, whereas their children are hoping to eventually feel better, needing to be authentic.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about being transgender in the Cape Fear region. My guest today, Nova Swanstrom, a psychologist specializing in LGBTQ+ issues, T.R. Nunley, program coordinator for Wilmington Transgender Support Services and a trans man, and Darlene, the parent of a teenager who is transgender. T.R. Nunley, you talked about eventually coming out to the community, your friends, people around you. What was it like when you came out to your own family?
So when I came out to my sister, she was super supportive. She has always been my champion, no matter what I'm going through. My mom was a little bit different. She did take it a little harder. She said, why can't you just be gay? And trying to explain it to her was really difficult. But over the years, she's become really accepting, and she's able to, she has an illness, so sometimes she gets my pronoun wrong. Sometimes she'll say my birth name, but then sometimes she'll say my sister's name. So we never know what's going on. But yeah,
let's talk about the pronouns and the names just for a moment.
Sure.
Because when I spoke with all three of you before this on-air discussion, all three of you said, get the pronouns right. Like, that was such an important part of support and respect. And the name as well, because the name changes, Darlene, as you know, when your child came to you and said, call me this now. Can you talk about just what that's like for you as a parent? And tell us what dead names are.
Well, dead naming is a very big deal for a trans teen, or I would say a trans adult. And dead naming is your birth name. It may be a nickname that you used to go by before you changed your name. And your name now, although, you know, my child is not 18 and their name can't be on their driver's license, is not on their checking account, is not on their school ID. We have had very much success at school with calling them by the name with which they prefer to be called. Dead naming is a bit of a microaggression, I would say. Nova can comment on that and TR, but it seems, I think, to my teen like a microaggression.
Okay, that's a really clear way of saying it. And TR, when people get your pronouns wrong, what does that feel like? What does that mean to you?
Every time that you get my pronoun wrong or another trans person's pronoun wrong, they hear it every time. Every time. Mm-hmm. So even if they ignore it or don't say anything, they definitely hear it. And it sort of just, it puts you in a space where you are not respected, not heard. And, you know, if someone calls me by my birth name, which is very rare, it just sort of puts me in a very bad space. And so with kids, you know, I have a couple of kids that, you know, they'll change their name, they'll try out new names every once in a while, and you just sort of have to go with the flow because it's hard to choose a name.
Nova Swanstrom, can you comment on what it's like for a trans person to have people around them not take seriously the right pronouns or not fully accept the name that comes with this out identity or this more authentic identity?
I think to piggyback off of what TR said, not only is it the sense of not being heard or respected, it's also being invisible. It's when people are trying to achieve their authenticity, no matter who it is, it's people want to be visible as themselves. And you know what Tiara was saying about trying things on, kids and teens need a safe space to be able to explore who they are. And especially with this, with sexuality, with gender identity. And sometimes parents and other people have a hard time with that. Sometimes parents don't want to reinforce something they think is going to be a phase, which oftentimes it's not a phase if you're looking at months and years of someone exploring this. So finding some middle ground. Not saying that's ideal. My recommendation will always be to use the name and pronouns that someone has. If the parent isn't there yet, it might be, let's choose a nickname. Let's not use the dead name. Let's not use the former pronouns. Let's find some middle ground until we can be where you're at. The exploration, for example, this is reversible. If parents have a fear that their child is going to turn to them in 10 years and say, why did you let me do this? Why did you reinforce this? I have yet to run across that in over 10 years of working with this community. and I have yet to come across it being a member of this community myself. So I think it's finding middle ground and working together as a family as much as possible.
And so I'm glad you brought this up, because this is going to be a fear for a lot of parents. And Darlene, I imagine you've wondered this. Is it a phase? Is this something, because kids are growing and their brains are still developing, and that the lobe with the executive function doesn't even finish its physical development until mid-20s or sometimes late 20s, in my case, probably 40. But what is the risk of letting a child, is there a risk in letting them explore these kinds of questions?
I think there's more of a risk not to.
Yep.
Do you want to expand on that, TR?
Well, if a child is questioning their gender and they want to explore that, I don't see a downside in it. The only thing that would happen is maybe that child feels, unheard, and they decide, well, if I'm not valued, then I don't want to live in this world. You know, they may try to commit suicide. There's a high percentage of trans kids that do commit suicide or attempt suicide because of being invalued.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about living as a transgender person in the Cape Fear region. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Transgender people are protected under the Civil Rights Act, but legal battles for transgender rights are still underway. And that says nothing about the social isolation that, without a supportive family or community, can be deadly. Transgender people are at significantly higher risk of death by suicide than other members of the LGBTQ community. With us today to help us understand the meaning of transgender and try to give us some sense of the experience of living as a transgender person are three people. Darlene is the mother of a transgender teenager. T.R. Nunley is program coordinator for Wilmington Transgender Support Services and is a trans man himself. And Nova Swanstrom is a psychologist who specializes in LGBTQ issues. And Darlene, while we were in the break, you had a sudden realization about fear of rejection by your child. Can you talk about what that is and what that means to you now?
Well, I knew that my child has been looking for acceptance. Children seek attention. They seek acceptance with what they wear, how they look. Whether they look more masculine or feminine that day. But until TR started talking about his fear of rejection with his process, it really, although I know, I've read about this, we've talked about this, but we've talked about, not being accepted, but being rejected and not being accepted sound to me now like two very, not so different, but different things. Rejection is hard, and that my child is struggling every day with a fear, a very real fear that I felt like I could feel from TR as he was saying it, of his experience with fear of rejection. It it even helps me to be more empathetic now going forward with my child, because there is, we've seen it. My child has an enormous amount of social anxiety at this point. And of course I've chalked a lot up to COVID, but coming out and being more out and being affirmed, having people see you as how you identify, the congruence of those two things is so important. And I think as a parent, that's probably what you said with fear of violence against transgendered people, and fear of my child being rejected on every level in society.
And Darlene, when you reached out to me, it was after the first edition of Queer in the Cape Fear. We were talking about just what it means to be gay here, what straight people can't see. We had two adults on, and you were just talking about how desperately afraid you can be sometimes for your child. And I think one of the things that one of our guests said on that show was, it gets better. Like, hang in there, it gets better. And you said, that's not enough. Do you understand? Do you understand how scary this is right now?
Right, because those were adults. I'm dealing with a minor. I'm dealing with a minor who is going to probably leave town and go off to university or whatever as a minor, who still has brain development going on. You know, cognitive growth, emotional growth, just understanding of the sort of the way the world works, if that makes sense. And the way the world works doesn't really make sense right now in a lot of ways, but the way the world works could be a lot more inclusive and loving without us having to relearn how to walk and chew gum.
T.R. Nunley, you talked about the support that you found when you came out, and Nova Swanstrom was part of that. The just the local LGBTQ community here has been part of that. But you said that your family it's been a journey for them in terms of their understanding.
Yes.
Can you talk about some ways that you still see either rejection or discrimination just in the Cape Fear region that maybe other people who aren't in the community, they can't see it, they don't know, are, you know, ways that people unwittingly contribute to lack of acceptance or actual rejection?
Okay, so I run a trans youth group, and you know, many of the kids have said that, you know, it's really hard, you know, for them to, for the teachers to get their names right. And oftentimes, even if the teacher does get their name right, as soon as a substitute comes into the classroom, they, you know, they'll call out that child's dead name. And oftentimes they won't respond, and they'll just get an absence. Also, I have several kids that avoid the bathroom at all costs. I have a kid that just recently was saying how they didn't use the bathroom for 18 hours. And then the other kids, you know, sort of joked around that, you know, they would just get a UTI. And for me, that seems just crazy. But for the kids, it's a coping mechanism. They don't have to deal with other kids. You know, they don't have to, like, choose a bathroom that they feel afraid to go into. And, you know, oftentimes the alternative for a bathroom for kids is use the nurse's room. So then you are then targeted. So they just don't want to be seen as that in school. So oftentimes they'll just you know, avoid the bathroom at all costs.
And you actually didn't have to deal with that yourself in school because you didn't come out as
correct
a trans man until you were an adult, but you did have your own struggle here
yes
in North Carolina.
Yes.
After, I mean, I guess there was Amendment 1 years ago, and there was also HB 2, what we colloquially call the bathroom bill, which was about the ability of smaller governments, states' right, cities and municipalities to make their own
yes
ordinances, but it really affected people who are transgender. Can you talk about what you went through?
Yeah, so this legislation, HB 2, happened kind of overnight. And, you know, I was contacted from various people about it. And, you know, I didn't really know much about it, but I knew that it was affecting trans people and the ability to use the bathroom that they would want to use. And at the time, you know, I have a beard and I look pretty masculine, and I was using the men's restroom at my work. I work for the county, and I contacted HR immediately and said, I don't know what to do. I don't know what bathroom to use because I don't want to break the law. And so they said, okay, wait. So I waited the whole day. I didn't use the bathroom, and because I'm a law-abiding citizen, you know, I work for the government, so I didn't want to break any laws. So when I got word from HR that I could not use the restroom, the male restroom, I had to go back to use the female restroom, and there wasn't a gender-neutral bathroom at work. And they equated me using the restroom as if I was to get a DUI.
You mean if you went into the men's restroom,
right?
The getting caught would be equivalent to getting a DUI. Does that mean you would be fired?
Right. That's what that was implied, that I would be fired. So I didn't really have a choice but to use the female restroom. And so I, you know, was working at social services, and so there would oftentimes be kids in the restroom, and I don't want to scare kids. I look like a man in the bathroom, in the female bathroom. And so, you know, when the kids were in there, I would just sort of wait and hide and, you know, not come out of the stall.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to scare kids. And, you know, in the beginning, I would have these, like, pieces of paper that I was giving out, you know, kind of explaining what was going on. And that was just at work. And then in any kind of public space, I wouldn't use the restroom because, you know, it was essentially illegal. And again, if I was caught, and I'm very well known in the community, I didn't want to get caught. And so I would just not use the bathroom in public, and, you know, at public spaces like parks and stuff. But if it was like a business, I would awkwardly go up to the customer service desk and say, can I use the men's bathroom? And they would look like I was weird, and I would just go use the men's restroom because obviously they said, sure, not a problem. But I did that to sort of cover myself because I didn't want to get in trouble. And if it came back on it, I would say, well, I asked for permission, and they said yes. And I did that for a year. And it was...
Which, you know, it sounds absurd that a full-grown adult has to go through those kinds of, you know, psychological, you know, that kind of struggle about just going to the bathroom.
Yeah. It was just crazy. And then I'd have, like, these different bathrooms where I knew that they were gender neutral, and those were the ones that I would go to. And I would have to explain to different businesses and people that I knew what I was doing so that they understood. But yeah, it was crazy. And so then I started doing a lot of public speaking about it because it was affecting me in such a big way. And, you know, there was all these, like, posters of, like, men, like, going into the women's restroom. And so at the end of, you know, at the end of my public speaking engagements, I would always say, you know, they're always looking for the man in the bathroom. I'm the man in the bathroom and you put me there. Right. And I was so afraid that, you know, like a father or a husband would see me come out of the bathroom and try to get into an altercation with me, or that a woman would have an argument with me about it. And I would just try to be like very unassuming when I go into the bathroom. So I'd be smiling and be like, I'm supposed to be here, you know, and try to be as, I don't know,
as non-threatening.
Non-threatening as possible.
Yeah. You know, we just have a few minutes left and I want to make sure that we get to this. You, as part of being an advocate in the community, TR, you have a list of vendors and places where trans people can go, like hair salons and stores and, you know, basic services, places where, you know, you can buy basic goods and services. And some of these things struck me as odd that they needed to be trans friendly. Can you just talk about why a trans person would need to go to, say, a hair salon?
So when I was trying to look more masculine, I would go to, like, Great Clips or, you know, like one of those types of locations. And, you know, I would say I want a very masculine haircut. And sort of at the end of the haircut, they would kind of, like, do their own little touch on it. So they would give me like pointy sideburns. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, I specifically said, I don't want a female haircut. So yeah, so now we have to have those places for people to go to where they feel comfortable, that people will listen. And hair is a really big deal for everybody, but especially trans people, because that's the one thing that you can definitely change immediately. You know, like Darlene was saying, like documents was really hard to change, but hair, makeup, those types of things is really easy to change. So let's just listen to people when they say they want a specific haircut.
Darlene, you have had to have a conversation with your child's grandparents. Can you just tell us briefly how that went? And what you learned from that conversation?
Well, my conversation was really about acceptance and dead naming, and about using the importance of using they/them pronouns. And while I do think they are trying, I do believe that they're trying. I believe that there is so much that there's such a deeper dive that families need to go through. Even, you know, if you're a close aunt or uncle, if you're a cousin, the taking it seriously is being taken seriously by a group of people who say, I love you, is so much more critical than being seen as you want to be seen and taken seriously from a person off the street. And I think, you know, my stance is that I really have to keep my child safe. And dead naming, misgendering, all are things that I just have to keep my child away from as much as possible.
Nova Swanstrom, in the few seconds we have left, how far have we come in the Cape Fear region, and how far do we have to go?
I think if we look at the past 10 years ago, there was nothing. Or closer to 15 years ago, there was nothing. Now we have medical providers, we have support groups, all from here through Jacksonville. We have much more than we ever had before. So I think if we keep fighting, we'll get even further.
And we will post resources on the web at whqr.org with this post. And that's this edition of Coastline. Darlene, Nova Swanstrom, T.R. Nunley, thank you all so much for being with us today and being willing to share your stories.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Rachel.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Andrew Craig engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.